Do you like it when somebody doesn't play by the rules? Anybody? Card games? You know, how we deal with each other? No, I don't think we're too happy when somebody doesn't play by the rules. And some rules are fairly simple, like no standing in the aisle, don't walk on the grass, this row is only for those with 10 items or less. None of you have ever broken that rule, right? But sometimes the rules are more serious and the consequences of breaking them are more serious. How about obey all traffic lights? I got an email from one of the people who comes here. His name is Tim Peck. He's in a wheelchair. He normally sits right over there. He said, "I'm sorry, Pastor. Well, here's the email. I'm sorry about missing church." And I thought, well, yeah, you know, miss church, you're in serious trouble, right? Yeah. Well, he gave a reason why he hasn't shown up. Tuesday, my wife Che and I went to San Francisco to the VA hospital to talk to my surgeon about my pending operation. 10 blocks from the hospital, we were hit by a van who ran a red light. He hit us on the driver's side rear and my scooter lift. He has a scooter that he needs to use as he gets around. It's hooked to the back of his van. The car knocked us sideways out of control. We hit the center divider island and went airborne. The scooter flew across the intersection and landed in the middle of the street. When we came out, we landed or hit an oncoming car almost head-on and veered off of it into a garage door and a brick pillar. The car we hit will be totaled, and the van that hit us also lost a rear bumper and the right side damaged. The garage lost its door. Our van, I am told, has damage to the rear quarter panel, and the bumper lift is damaged and inoperative. The scooter still runs, amazingly enough, but is damaged. Che's seatbelt let go upon hitting the car, and she hit the steering wheel when we hit the pillar, and the airbags did not deploy. She is badly bruised and in a lot of pain. I have whiplash and a good deal of pain. We spent 5 hours at the San Francisco General Hospital ER Trauma Center undergoing tests. Said, "I'm sorry I won't be there Sunday." I rode back and said, "You're excused." What happens when we don't obey the rules? Sometimes not so much. Sometimes quite a bit. I mean, we're thankful that no one was killed. And a lot of people could have been in this kind of a serious accident. Well, today we want to talk about rule keeping of a different sort. We're finishing up the third week of a 3-part series on finding our way to our true home in the loving presence of God, our Father. We call it Finding Home. It's based on the parable of the prodigal son. We're using that as our roadmap. And so far, the last two weeks, we've looked at one son each week. We started with the younger son, and then last week we looked at the older son. So now it's time to look at the father, who is the key player in this passage. The younger son decided to rebel against his father. The older son decided to be obedient, but the fact of the matter is both of these sons followed the same rule. They had their rule. Their rule is, get what you can, when you can, however you can. Both sons wanted the same thing, control over their father's wealth. I want my share of the inheritance. It's just that they went about it in different ways. The younger son says to his father, "I want my share of the inheritance right now. I don't care that you're still alive. I don't care that everything in our culture and under God would say you wait until the father passes on and then you get your rightful share." No. The younger son says, "I want my share and I want it now." It's as good as if he was saying to his father, "I wish you were dead, because I want your stuff." The older son chooses a different path. He chooses to earn his share through good behavior. He was playing the do-gooders game. The obedient child, always doing what is asked of him, never making a ruckus, always obeying the laws and the rules of the family system. But the key truth is, neither of the son wanted a real relationship with his dad. They only wanted what the dad had to offer, money. And so both sons were in the wrong, whether they are acting responsibly or irresponsibly, whether they're appearing to be righteous or unrighteous, good or bad, doesn't matter. They're both playing by the same rule. Give me what I can, however I can, whenever I can. Well, what rule does God follow? We've looked at the rule of the sons. We've seen how they were living out and playing out their lives. Well, what's the rule that the father is playing in this parable? Because the father in the parable represents God. Over my many years of life as a child of God, as a disciple of Jesus, I've come to realize a very important truth. When it comes to our normal lives and our normal relationships and even our normal sense of fairness of right and wrong, God doesn't play by the rules. He doesn't. I mean, we've all grown up with a set of rules that seem right to us, and we can state them like this. These are the kinds of ways we say it. We say, there's no such thing as a free lunch. We say, he had it coming. We say, what goes around comes around. Which is another way of stating a whole religious belief of Buddhism called karma. Karma is a system of thinking where if you do good in this life, next time around on the wheel, when you're reincarnated, you will be in a higher level. If you're living out your life as a human, you'll be born into a higher caste. Because you've done well in this life, you'll be rewarded in the next. It's all about following the rules. It's all about being fair. Now, what do we mean by fair? Well, fair is to be even-handed, equitable, giving others what they have rightly earned. Equal pay for equal work, right? It's the way we do it. It's the way we think it's right. But here's the fact. God doesn't play by that rule. He doesn't play by this rule that we hold so dearly. He just is so upsetting. He offers people a blessing they have not earned and do not deserve. Jesus revealed in another parable this radical approach. It's called the parable of the workers in the vineyard. It's found in Matthew 20. We do not have the time to actually read the passage and go through it, but write down Matthew 20, the parable of the workers in the vineyard. Very quickly, a landowner goes out and it's time to harvest. And so he goes out at 9 in the morning and he says, I need day laborers. He goes into the village square where all the day laborers are there next to Home Depot. They're all waiting to get picked up and hired. And he says, all right, I need workers to go out into my vineyard and harvest grapes. And a whole bunch of guys say, okay, I'm good with that. And off they go. And he says, I will pay you a denarius, which was standard fare, one day's labor. I'm going to pay you for a day's labor because you're going to give me a day's work, right? He goes back into the square at 12 noon. He doesn't have enough workers. He realizes, I've got to get this harvest in. I need more workers. So he hires them. He says, come work for me. I will pay you what is right. They go, cool. And they go off to the vineyard. He comes at 3 in the afternoon. He still needs more workers. And so he hires a bunch more. They go off to the vineyard. Now he comes back one more time. It's 5 in the afternoon. Now, guess who's left over? The brightest bulb on the tree? No. These are the guys who've sat around. These are the guys, maybe they got some Starbucks in their hand and they've been shooting the breeze the whole day. Nobody else has picked them up. But the landowner says to them, I need you. And they go, oh, okay. I'll give you an hour, because that's what they put in, from 5 to 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock rolls around. Everybody's done working. The landowner says to his head guy, okay, time to pay him up, because you worked the day, you got the day's wage. These guys are living hand to mouth. Day's wage gets you bread on the table that night and breakfast the next morning. And he said, I want you to take the guys who worked the least amount, the guys I hired last, I want you to pay them first and then go backwards in order. And so they line up. The guys who worked for 1 hour, the foreman gives them a denarius, 1 day's wage. Everyone is startled. What's this about? They worked for an hour and they got a whole day's wage. The guys at the back of the line now, the guys who worked all day, are saying to themselves, oh, boy, we hit it good with this landowner. He's a generous kind of guy. I mean, if he's giving them for a 1 hour's work a whole day's wage, guess what we're going to get? But then the startling truth is revealed to them, because as everybody starts to get paid and they go through the line, everybody gets the same amount, a denarius. That's it. No increases from the original amount. And so these guys who come through at the end, they've worked all day, and now they're grumbling. Now they're complaining. Now they're angry. And they go to the landowner and say, what's the deal? We worked all through the heat of the day, and you're giving us a lousy denarius? That's it? When you paid these guys who only worked an hour toward the end of the day, not so hot at all, they had it easy, and they're getting the same amount we are? What's the deal? And Jesus concludes his parable by having the landowner make a statement. It's found in Matthew 20, verse 15. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Why should you be jealous if I want to be generous? What's with that? Why are you jealous because I am generous with what I have? We agreed, didn't we, at the very beginning? I will pay you a denarius. You come out and work for me all day. And you all said yes. So I'm just fulfilling my part of the bargain here, right? I'm giving you what you rightfully earned, but I decided to be generous with everybody else. Does that seem fair? Think about it. If you were one of those workers who worked through the entire day, would you call that landowner fair? I'd say, I got ripped off. He's being way too generous with these guys. And I'm only getting, well, I agree to it, yeah, but it's just not right. Tim Keller, when he wrote his book on the parable of the prodigal son, he said, you know, we really need to change the name. We need to call this the parable of the prodigal God. Now, you have to think for a minute, what does the word prodigal mean? What does the word prodigal mean? Because for years and years I used to think, and probably many of you still think, the word prodigal means immoral, debauched, degenerate, dissolute. Somebody who just completely messes up their life in wild living, like the younger son did. But that's not what the word means. The word prodigal means spendthrift. The prodigal is one who is reckless in his spending, who doesn't seem to know the value of a dollar, is throwing money around, hand over fist, handing it out. And in the parable, it's the father who is really the prodigal. He is lavish with his generous spirit, his forgiveness, his ability to overlook terrible slights to both the younger, from the younger and the older son. Lavish in his desire to see his sons come home. Jesus' message is clear to us. The Father is our Heavenly Father, and you and I are living out one of those two storylines, the younger son or the older son. Some of us come in here today and we have been the younger son, doing our own thing, blowing up our resources, blowing up our lives. But a lot of us have come in here today and we've playing out the older son's timeline. We've been good. We're good people. We work hard at doing the right thing. In fact, we're kind of proud that we're in here worshiping God like good religious people should be doing. And we're not out in the street somewhere. And we haven't blown up our lives. We've been responsible with our money, at least, sort of. We've been responsible with our decisions, well, most of the time. We're leading good, upright lives. But we're both, the younger and the older, in trouble. And we both need to hear the heart of the gospel message. What is the gospel? This is the gospel. The gospel of Christ is the good news that there is a prodigal God who is aching to share his love and blessing with all people. Those who have earned it and those who haven't. Because in reality, none of us have earned it. Tim Keller writes in his book, Jesus does not divide the world into the moral good guys and the immoral bad guys. The parable blows that kind of thinking up. He shows us that everyone is dedicated to a project of self-salvation, of using God and others to get in order to get power and control for themselves. We are just going about it in different ways. The gospel is distinct from the other two approaches. In its view, everyone is wrong, everyone is loved, and everyone is called to recognize this and change. A long time ago, a newspaper asked a question. What is wrong with the world? G.K. Chesterton was living at that time. This is in a former century. He was a Catholic, a committed follower of Jesus Christ, had a brilliant mind, wrote wonderful books. You'd think he was a great guy. Well, he answered that newspaper's question. One sentence. Dear sirs, what's wrong with the world? I am. Sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton. What's wrong with the world? I am. I'm what's wrong with the world. I'm the one who is a sinner desperately needed of forgiveness and reconciliation. I'm the one who needs God's work in my mind and my heart to change me from the inside out, to cure me of selfishness and self-centeredness and self-righteousness. This is an attitude of someone who has grasped the message of Jesus. What's wrong with the world? I am wrong with the world. So there's only one appropriate response to all of this. If the gospel says everyone is wrong, everyone is loved, and everyone is called to recognize this and change, well then all of us, everyone, needs to humbly admit that whether we've chosen the path of self-fulfillment or self-righteousness, either we've been the younger son or the older son, it doesn't matter. We all need the grace of Jesus Christ. We've not earned a place. Our works, whether good or bad, won't get us inside the door of the Father's home. It is the humble who are accepted. Everyone must humbly bow before the Lordship of Jesus Christ. It's not what I think. but what God thinks that really matters. The proud and hard in mind will not find acceptance. Whether you're the younger son or the older son, it's the humble who find acceptance. And as we close this up, I want to make one other major point. Because this parable, the prodigal son, the prodigal God, whatever we call it, is the third in a series of parables. If you go in Luke 15 and you start with verse 1, you see the historical context for it. For it says there that Jesus was eating with tax gatherers and sinners. Now, these were two key labels that were given to people that the religious of Jesus' day didn't like. Because the people who were religious, good church-going people, they'd be synagogue-going people back then, good self-righteous people, well, there were people who didn't obey the Jewish law. They were out and about doing their own thing. They were not committed to God the way they should be. And so the Pharisees, they were the most religious of the group that Jesus ran into. They were the ones who were the most self-righteous. And the scribes, these were the people who studied the Word of God meticulously to understand and apply it. These two groups got together and started complaining again to Jesus, saying, "Why are you associating with this riffraff? Why are you spending time with these people that God condemns?" And in response, Jesus tells three stories. And they're up on the screen. The first is the lost sheep. A shepherd brings home his flock out from grazing. And as the shepherd is wont to do, he stands at the door, the opening of the sheep pen, and he counts his sheep as they go in. And it's one, and it's two, and it's three, and they get to 99, and that's the last one in. And the shepherd goes, "Wait a minute, there's supposed to be 100. There's supposed to be 100 sheep here. Where's the 100th one? The 99 are in. They're safe. They're good." So the shepherd, well, he's got a lost sheep. The second story is the lost coin. A woman, a widow, has 10 coins that are her life savings. It's all she's got left. And she's counting up. I guess maybe she had a little leather purse, and she opens it up and she counts them out, and it's one and it's two and it's three, and she gets to 9, and that's it. A coin is missing. And the third parable talks about a lost son, actually two lost sons. There's a lost sheep, there's a lost coin, and there's lost sons. Three stories, same idea. And then we see what goes on, the commonalities. Starts out with somebody gets lost, or something gets lost. And then something gets found. And then there's a party that breaks out. Because when the shepherd finds the 100th sheep, he brings it home and he says to his friends, "Let's have a party. I found my lost sheep." When the woman finds her 10th coin, she calls her friends together and say, "Let's have a party. I found my lost coin." When the prodigal son comes back home, the father of the estate says, "Let's party. For my son was lost and now is found." Parties are always breaking out in Jesus' stories. Because people are excited about things getting found. And of course, already inherent in what we've already said, there are three all-out searches. The shepherd leaves the 99 in the pen. And he goes hither and yon and everywhere, trying to find that lost sheep, because he knows that sheep is in trouble. Sheep can't defend themselves against lions and bears and thieves. They're easy pickings. Got to find that sheep. And it doesn't matter the math of it. Now, what's one sheep out of 100? No. One's missing. I must find this animal. The woman, when she loses the coin, it says she tears the house apart, looking for that lost coin. I must have the 10th coin. It is precious to me. And when the son comes home, the father leaves his house. Do you notice how he leaves the house? He leaves the house when the prodigal son shows up. He runs to him and embraces him. And then when the older son, well, when he finds out what's going on, what does it say? He refused to go in the house. He refuses to join the party. He says, I'm not going in there. And the father could have sent a servant out and said, get your butt in here. The father goes out. He leaves the party. He leaves the younger son. He goes out to the other son and is having another conversation with a son outside of the house, pleading with him to come home and to enter into the celebration. God is pursuing. You see the theme that keeps coming up again and again? God is reaching out. God is on the search. God is pursuing what is lost. Henry Nouwen, in his book on the return of the prodigal son, reveals what for him was a brand new insight in all of this. He says, now I wonder whether I have sufficiently realized that during all this time, God has been trying to find me, to know me, to love me. The question is not, how am I to find God? But how am I to let myself be found by Him? The question is not, how am I to know God? But how am I to let myself be known by God? And finally, the question is not, how am I to love God? But how am I to let myself be loved by God? God is looking into the distance for me, trying to find me, and longing to bring me home. That is the heart of God. The heart of God is reaching out to people who are far from Him with the desire to bring them home. He's on a search and rescue mission. You like those kind of stories? Search and rescue missions, when it ends well? And what people might go through in the search, and how joyful they are when they come and find what they're looking for? I've always been attracted by television commercials. When I was growing up, my mother used to say to me, I ignored shows, but when commercials came in, I would run in and stare at the set. So when a commercial comes on TV, I'm looking at it now, of course, with a little more nuanced understanding and looking for what's the central message of this? What are they trying to sell, really? They're never trying to sell alcohol. They're trying to sell companionship and laughter and fun and being included and all that, right? That's what a booze commercial is all about. It's fun and being beautiful and having a great time with really cool-looking people. And if you drank this booze, you'd be drunk. But they don't show that. Okay. Get off that. Here's a search and rescue that I saw on TV. It was put out by Dignity Health. I'll just throw that out there for the fun of it. They have chosen the tack that we want to associate our brand of help with feel-good kind of stories. And here it is. On the left, you see a dog that is marooned. It's in a river, flowing basin, concrete river in L.A., and here's the guy going after him. Now, be patient with me, because this is going to take about 3.5 minutes to watch the whole thing that we downloaded from a TV newscast, Channel 11 News, Fox 11. I don't know how you feel about Fox, but I don't care, because... Let's roll the video, shall we, and listen to the dialogue.